I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. Nish is on the road this week, moving her family from Salt Lake City to central Idaho. So I'm joined for this episode by guest co-host and Pod Squad member Rachel Johnson. Rachel's the executive minister of communications at Riverside Church in New York City. And you can hear her these days on Riverside's Be Still and Go podcast series for Lent. This week, we're talking about how religious institutions handle allegations of sexual abuse, about Bally's annual Day of Silence, and the March for Our Lives, taking place in Washington, D.C. this weekend and at major cities near you. Before we begin, heartfelt thanks to those of you who have decided to support Impolite Company by becoming monthly patrons of the show. If you like what we're doing here, you can click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. It's really easy and you can invest in the future of this great show for as little as $1 a month. We're planning a Google Hangout with patrons in the month of April, so there's still time to join. I'm not saying the Hangout will include an Amy Grant sing-along led by my four-year-old, but I'm not saying it either. No Nish this week means no 3 minutes of Nish, which is probably okay because I am still coasting on the fumes of her epic rant last week. And frankly, I'm not sure our explicit rating could could take another rant right now. Instead, we'll jump right into our first topic today, which is a rare look at some positive signs in confronting sexual abuse inside religious institutions. It's still tragic, of course, because every one of these stories begins with abuse, often of someone young. But after decades and centuries of either denying abuse or insisting the allegations be handled internally, it does count as good news when a church or other institution opts instead for something like transparency or accountability. So the first case I want to just remind listeners about is one that Nish and I talked about maybe a couple of months ago. It was in early January when a former youth group member came out and wrote publicly about her experience of being sexually assaulted by Andy Savage, who at the time was her youth pastor down in Texas, but who more recently has been a leading figure and I think was one of the founding pastors at High Point Church in the Memphis area. It was a bit of a disturbing story, not just for the abuse itself, but for the way that High Point dealt with it after the woman, Jules, released her statement. Just to remind you, the head pastor at High Point talked to the congregation, emphasized repeatedly that this was something that had happened a long time ago, as if that matters, and emphasized that they loved Andy, they believed Andy, and they wanted him to stay. And the church ended up giving Andy a standing ovation. In the meantime, the church, we will give them some credit, asked him to go on a leave of absence, and they did an internal investigation. And they have ended up calling for his resignation. Earlier this week, High Point announced that Andy Savage would be leaving the church, and he released a letter of his own. And I want to just read a couple statements from this because it has some of the good and the bad in terms of church folks starting to finally maybe learn a little bit about transparency and consequences, but also not quite getting there. Andy continues to refer to the relationship that he had with Jules, implying that it was consensual, but inappropriate because of the difference in power, because he was his youth pastor. She continues to say, as it appears that he admitted at the time, that it was unwanted sexual contact and that he, in fact, was very coercive and that it was something she didn't want. At the same time, he says that he notes that while she was coming forward, his focus was on protecting himself. His comment in his letter here is, when Jules cried out for justice, I carelessly turned the topic to my own story of moral change, as if getting my own life in order should help to make up for what she went through and continues to go through. Morality is meant to guard against injustices, not to minimize them, to compensate for them, or to obscure them. I agree with Jules that of all places, we as the church should be getting this right. So at least in that one instance, this church appears to be on the right path. And I think by having Andy Savage leave, assuming that he doesn't turn around and Mark Driscoll like start up another ministry in another church in 6 months from now, I think maybe this can be something of a model that other churches can turn to. In the Catholic Church, where we've heard a lot, obviously, over the past few decades about child sex abuse, the very highest leader in the church to be accused and put on trial is Australian Cardinal George Pell, who is currently testifying in an Australian court, which is deciding how to try him and has been hearing from alleged victims who have accusations against the cardinal going back years, but who have just now come forward. So that in itself, with such a high profile figure, is notable. And finally, I wanted to bring our attention to a pretty remarkable editorial in Christianity Today. And here, Rachel, I wanted to get kind of your thoughts as somebody who has gone through divinity school, who's gone through the ordination process, because I think what's notable about CT's editorial here is that they are calling for independent investigation of Sovereign Grace Ministries, which is a collection of about 70 churches. They've got just a whole heck of a lot of churches around the world, mostly Reformed churches. And they have been accused of repeatedly failing to respond to accusations of child sex abuse. They've lost thousands of members over it. And I want to give a shout out to Rachel Denhollander, I think that's how you pronounce it, who was the driving figure in bringing justice to the female gymnasts who were abused by Larry Nassar in Michigan. And she used to attend a Sovereign Grace church, and she has also been really outspoken on how, as Andy Savage said in his letter, the church needs to be out in front and the one that's doing right on this. And so I wanted to take just a couple of minutes here, not too long, to talk about why independent investigations are so important and why this whole tradition of churches not wanting to air their dirty laundry, to use a phrase that I'm so sick of, and wanting to deal with things internally needs to be over and should have long been over years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's an important conversation that we need to be having. And the sad fact is that churches historically, regardless of denomination or tradition, traditional backgrounds, have been really, really good at pointing out the sins of others and not as good at talking about our own, even though when you catch us in our moments of honesty, we will freely admit that we are institutions made up of human beings who have the same faults as everybody else. But it's hard. It's hard for us for a lot of reasons, in part because, this isn't something that you necessarily learn in seminary. I mean, my divinity school education was, memorizing Greek verb conjugations and trying to get all of the books of the Bible straight and, which tell which stories and complicated, mind-bending systematic theology. There isn't a course.
So not institution management.
Exactly. Exactly. Seminaries are just waking up to the idea that maybe we should teach pastors how to manage their budgets. We haven't quite gotten to the part where how do we manage issues of sexual abuse. I don't I can't think of a single course that I could have even taken on that. And so it's hard for a number of reasons, and we're just not equipped. And I think a positive movement for the church to do, in addition to saying, to admitting when these problems exist within the church, is to admit that we may not be equipped to know how to handle them. And that's okay, because there are people who do, and we can rely on them, and we can bring them into our world without fear, because our ultimate goal should be finding truth and protecting the victims.
And yet, as you say, there are reasons why churches in particular have been hesitant to go to outside authorities. And I know in some cases that stems from maybe a long fear or even history with outside authorities persecuting religious communities. But for most churches, it's been a long, long time, like centuries, since that was a problem. Why still are folks hesitant to turn to the one area of our society, the criminal justice system, that is both set up to handle this and doesn't always do it perfectly, but that we are supposed to go to?
Yeah, no, I mean, self-preservation, I think, is always a motivating factor for everyone. You know, as you mentioned, it was for the pastor, and the church is not immune to that. I think there is also a suspicion of people outside. I think just about any religious group, whether it's justified or not, has an inherent knee-jerk reaction to people outside of our traditions, of our common language and our common way of being, don't get us, and therefore there is more of a likelihood of them not only coming after what is inherently wrong and needs to be addressed, but some aspect of who we think we are that is important and central to our religious identity. And, you know, that is always at play when you're talking about a community welcoming people from the outside in. And particularly in this instance, where it's not, you know, we're welcoming you in and under positive circumstances, but we are asking you to investigate and kind of tear apart our community and find what's wrong there.
Right. And nobody ever wants to have their brand tarnished, apparently, or especially, as we've discussed before, in the American religious marketplace, which is so unusual among countries where religion flourishes for reasons related to competition, but also provides incentives for people to cover things up. Not that the U.S. is the only place that has a problem with this, but that can provide a particular disincentive here.
And I think there's one other important point on that as well is, right, nobody wants to hurt their brand. And the church is a brand that has been hurting recently, right? You know, we know all of the stories that are out there about the decline in church attendance. And I think there is also this idea that if the church were to be open and honest when abuse happens, then that decline will just, you know, go even faster. Ironically, I think part of the reason for the decline is because the church refuses to be honest about its shortcomings.
Exactly.
And so by not admitting that there are abuses that need to be addressed, that is what's driving people away. But we still have this mentality of, no, if we're honest about it, then people won't come.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. And I'm going to move us on to our second topic, because our time is a little bit shorter today, but also because we have a rare happier story, maybe, which is not what we always do here at Impolite Company. And it's also a completely new to me story. And I will happily admit that I am not the expert on all things religious, but still, it is a nice, pleasant surprise when I run across a religion story that I truly had no idea about. So our second topic today was inspired by an Associated Press report about, again, this story that was entirely new to me. It's a day of silence that is observed every spring on the Indonesian island of Bali. And I guess I kind of knew that Bali was predominantly Hindu, but I didn't realize that they have this holiday, which is called Naipi. I think I'm getting that right. Which serves as the start of the new year in the Saka calendar, which is used by Hindus in Bali. And what made this year's observance of Naipi last weekend especially notable was that for the first time on the island, phone companies agreed to turn off mobile internet everywhere on the island for 24 hours for this observance. And because it's home to 4 million people, you can imagine that that's a fairly big deal if nobody can get on their phones or on Facebook or Instagram or anything. For 24 hours during Naipi, Balinese stay indoors. They cover up their windows. They have no television on, no radio, no internet access, and often they don't even turn on any lights, which I admit sounds lovely to me. But I am the kind of person who daydreams about going on silent retreats. So I know that's not going to appeal to everybody. It did get me thinking, though, because a few weeks ago we had on Mark Oppenheimer, who was pointing out that Christians sometimes like to pick and choose the parts of Judaism and more ancient traditions that they like. So in this case, we were talking about the awful, embarrassing practice of some Christian churches holding Purim parties. And he was pointing out that if Christians really wanted to do it right, they would try, say, observing the Sabbath. And so one thing I wanted to hear from you is, as a pastor who has to work on the Sabbath, how you find space for taking time for reflection and kind of unplugging during the week. And also why this has become a part of Christian tradition, which arguably was pretty central to the early Christians, that we almost never talk about it anymore.
Yeah. It is a sad and almost lamentable fact that in many ways Christianity's lost the language of Sabbath. And part of what is sad about it for me is I think the reason we lost it is because it's just not convenient. And, you know, I think we used to be better about it when... you know, it's easy not to shop on Sundays if all the stores are already closed. Our culture, unlike Bali, has now moved to a place where we're no longer arranging our commerce around a particular religious tradition. And so, you know, Chick-fil-A is the one thing you can't get on Sundays right now for reasons of faith. And that is part of the part that I am, I guess, most sad about, because it shows that we're really only going to engage in practices of our faith if it's easy to do so. But if it becomes more inconvenient, then maybe that's what we can let go. And I'm just as guilty of that as I think just about anybody, not only because I work on Sundays.
It's kind of part of the job for you.
It is part of the job. I'll go ahead and admit that I have my Apple Watch on, you know, while I'm in the service, and the idea of the internet going down and me missing something critical is a little scary. So the idea of completely turning off the internet, even on Sunday, while it sounds absolutely wonderful in many ways, there's a small part of me that's like, but what am I going to do if something happens and I don't know?
Just tell me you guys don't do hashtags during the service.
If you want to follow along Riverside Sermons, go to our Twitter account, and we do have a Sunday Sermon hashtag. So I'm sorry. Oh,
good Lord. I was just kidding. All right.
Carrying on. Yes. I am not tweeting from the pulpit, if that helps at all. Yeah. No, so it would be a wonderful thing. And I'm thinking of stories that I've heard from, my dad, my grandmother, who would refuse to do any work on Sundays. And so I think he was leaving for camp Sunday afternoon, a Bible camp or something like that, he and his siblings. And she stayed up into the, I don't know if it went past midnight, but she stayed up late on Saturday night to get all of their stuff ready because she refused to do any of the work on Sunday, even though she would have had time. And that's just not part of our culture anymore. So I do, as a pastor who has to work on Sundays, try to find times to block off Sabbath moments. Try to be better about not checking in on work and not being technology dependent on the days that I do have off. What does it look like to maybe integrate Sabbath practices into my Saturday instead of my Sunday or my Friday? What does it look like to maybe start or end the day with moments of Sabbath, reading, prayer, reflection? And I think those are all good and important. And, I want to say that not just to soothe myself, but for all of us who are trying to carve out moments of rest and connection with God in the midst of what is a very chaotic world and very chaotic lives. But I do think there's something lost in not setting aside, a whole block of time, a whole day, and saying, as Scripture says, for 6 days we get to do what we want. This is the one day where we're gonna set aside for God. I don't have answers. I just wish we and myself were different.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. I know this even has been changing little by little, but still, in a lot of parts of, say, Europe, shops are shut down on Sundays. And, for all that a lot of conservatives like to bash Europe for turning away from religion, it's so fascinating that that aspect of observing the Sabbath has held over past the existence and really thriving of a lot of religious communities there.
Yeah.
It's always a shock as an American to go someplace that doesn't have 24-hour, 7 days a week service available.
Right.
But there's something perhaps that we can learn from that. So before we go, I want to make sure we talk about something that Rachel and I have been discussing since literally the day after the 2016 election. I was in New York to cover the election for work. And we met up for lunch on the Upper West Side and self-medicated with bananas Foster French toast. Or maybe that was just me having the French toast. But
oh, no, it was delicious.
It helped. It helped somewhat. And, I remember even though it took several months to kind of work more through the topic of what was going on among white evangelicals, even then we were talking about the role that fear is playing in that community, and particularly among conservative evangelicals. We talked about the idolization of guns. And what I thought was so interesting was your point that you brought up, which is how much evangelicals and even some conservative Catholics have embraced over the past few decades the idea that we should not just protect life and honor the sanctity of life, but we should do what we can to avoid death at all costs. And for a faith that teaches us that we should look forward to eternal life with God, we're not saying that anybody should be psyched about dying or blasé about particularly unjust deaths. But it's a little disconsonant the idea that evangelicals are so afraid of death that they almost fetishize life and will do whatever they can, including encouraging Christians to kill others who pose a danger to them in order to hang on to life for as long as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost seems as if we can't hold not even competing views, but nuanced views in tension of one another, with one another. You know, for many Christians, particularly white evangelicals, but as you say, also, you know, Catholics and Christians outside the evangelical tradition, life has become the identifying marker of what it means to be a white evangelical. You know, if you're known for anything, one of the things you're going to be known for is valuing the sanctity of life. And I think there are certainly, you know, arguments and support for that in Scripture, but we've reached the point where we have to protect life to such an extent that the idea that we may be called one day to lay down our lives seems almost reprehensible. The idea that that our response to external evil in the world that could take away life isn't that our response to that evil is, well, then I must meet violence with violence. I must, rather than put my life on the line, do whatever I can to eliminate those who would threaten life. And that's where I think the Christian message gets lost. That's where I think the message and life of Jesus gets lost. You know, there are plenty of references throughout Scripture to why we are not to be afraid. You know, so many verses that say, do not fear, do not be afraid. And I think the reason is because we know just what fear can do to a person, how fear can warp a person's values. I think that's why there's such a consistent message. And there's, you know,
and because life was really pretty tough for Israelites and right. then for the early yes. Christians as well. They had a lot of reasons to be afraid.
Yes. Yeah. And then the idea is, don't let the things of the world that frighten you, the very real things. You know, this isn't to dismiss the presence of evil in the world, but to say that your faith is stronger than that, and that death does not need to be feared, because we
death
believe
is not final.
Because death is not final. We believe in a God who resurrects life out of death, and so this idea that we have to avoid it at all costs, I think leads to Christians taking some very strange views that just, you know, frankly don't seem biblical or Christian to me at all. Our support of gun culture, our support of torture, our unwillingness to accept refugees because...
Right, for the very, very, very slim chance that one could pose a threat to you.
Right.
You should then close the doors for people fleeing genocide.
Right. Yeah. There was a tweet that Donald Trump Jr. put out. So
is this the Skittles tweet?
The Skittles tweet, right? The Skittles tweet. The bowl of Skittles, and you know, if you knew that just three of these Skittles would kill you, would you take a handful?
And Jesus would say yes.
If it meant saving thousands of lives. If the bowl of Skittles was refugees fleeing from persecution and taking a handful meant that thousands could be saved, I think we unqualifyingly know what Jesus would say.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is that this fairly new, I think, turn towards protecting ourselves at all cost. It exists hand in hand with an obsession with persecution. And historically, that's always been a little warped. There have always been folks in the Christian community who focused a little too much on the stories of the martyrs and who maybe even kind of hoped for the chance to be a martyr. But that told you something about how the community as a whole thought about the idea of laying down your life for your faith and understanding that there was more than just this life. I know so many other people who grew up evangelical have heard what I assume is an apocryphal story about some youth group somewhere where the youth group leader thought it would be a good idea one evening to have somebody dressed up in, like, I don't know, terrorist gear, burst into the room and ask everybody who was a Christian to stand up and they would be killed. And it was supposed to be like a test of who was willing to stand up for their faith. And I can't remember what youth group jamboree I heard this at, because of course, you know, we went to a ton of jamborees. But I remember this being told as even if it was a hypothetical, you know, a personal test of how much your faith meant to you and how willing you would be to stand up and witness and not be like Peter and deny your faith, even if it meant you knew you were going to be killed. And we've gone from that to, I guess, the argument that you'd want to be caring at church, which we hear from pastors who encourage their congregants to carry their firearms to church, because that way, when the supposed terrorist burst in, instead of standing up for your faith, you could mm-hmm. just pull out your sidearm right there and shoot him dead.
Yeah. Yeah. We're supposed to, you know, as you say, be prepared to give an accounting for our faith, to and if that means putting our very lives on the line, well, then, you know, that's part of the deal of being Christian, and there is this this idea now that rather than laying down my life for my faith, I am to go on the offensive for it. I am to lay down someone else's life instead. And I think it's a fascinating notion, and I believe is one that honestly can, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, can be best exemplified, perhaps, in a pretty radical shift we've seen in this country over the last, you know, five, six decades between how Christianity in America has been perceived and represented. So, you know, sitting on this side of the religious right, it's hard to remember that Christianity in America was once identified with liberal Protestant theologians and the civil rights movement. I mean, that was a movement born in the pews. And so the voice of Christianity for one time was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We're coming up on the 50th year of his, or 50th anniversary of his assassination in 2 weeks. And King's message over and over, a message that he not only preached, but that he gave, you know, lived out with his life and death, was that a better world is possible, but you may have to die to achieve it. And you had people literally putting their lives on the line in freedom rides and on the other opposite side of pit bulls and fire hoses, to try to achieve that better world, that kingdom of God, that beloved community that the King said is possible, but it may require self-sacrifice. And for various reasons, we rejected that form of Christianity. I think as a country as a whole, we've moved away from it. White evangelicals in particular, I think, never got on board with it in the first place. They just continued to exist in their subculture that they had been living in.
Right. Well, I was going to say that King's Christian leadership was not a model that white conservative evangelicals ever accepted or wanted. And I wonder how much of this obsession with persecution, but not with putting your body on the line, has to do with the fact that white conservative evangelicals in the U.S. never have faced that kind of immediate persecution. I mean, you can talk about the cultural stigma, and certainly that has been very real after the Scopes trial and is still real in some segments of society. But American evangelicals, they fled persecution to come to the United States, but in their homeland, they have never been at risk, really.
Right. And yet we have these stories that, you know, there may come a time when you will be asked at gunpoint whether you're willing to admit that you are a Christian or not.
You know what it reminds me of is Trump saying that if he was at Parkland High School, he knows he would have run in there unarmed and tried to tackle the gunman. It's this, like, it's wishful because you know you won't be put in that position. And I want to just make sure, while we're still talking about this, that I make clear that I think that youth group story is banana pants. And it is a screwed up way to get people to think about their faith and what it means to them. And I think that given that there is real religious persecution around the world and people are dying for their faiths, that it's an important issue and we should be willing to do what we can to make sure that nobody is being persecuted for their faith. But here, and the way that white evangelicals talk about it, it's just hard, hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and you and Nish have talked about this before in previous episodes, I think there is a component here of the individual versus systems, right? So it's, you know, part of what you hear in both the justification for why so many white evangelicals say they want to have guns, which protection is the number one reason given, more than hunting and sport. It's this idea of putting ourselves in the role of defender instead of the one being sacrificed. And it's very easy to, I think, like the idea of yourself in the role of protector, of the being the one that stands between the innocent and evil, when you haven't been on the other side of systems of oppression for decades and decades. You know, then you don't want to think of evil in terms of the systems that have been keeping people down and constantly taking away their dignity. You want to align yourself with the person who is in power. And it's much easier to do that if you haven't been on the other side of systems of oppression.
Right. And a person with a gun is not dangerous because of the gun. They're dangerous because their heart has been turned by Satan and they're evil.
Right.
Because that's something you know how to deal with. And you're willing to deal with.
And that an individual can deal with. And doesn't require you to sacrifice yourself to change that person. It requires moving that person.
Oh, there's so much to chew on with this. And I'm so glad you could join us for this week. Because as you know, this is something we continue to talk about, but I think every time we do, we get a little closer to being able to kind of peel back the curtain and maybe talk to some folks who still have this worldview in ways that maybe will lead to productive dialogue. At least I hope so. So to wrap up the show every week, as you know, we like to leave listeners with a recommendation, maybe a TV show, a movie, or some music. Rachel, what do you have for us this week?
Absolutely. So I, like Amy Nish, am an avid fan of The Crown and binge watched all the way through and am now, you know, stuck without any more episodes to watch. And that, when I was wallowing in, you know, my misery of being out, a friend recommended to me Victoria, a BBC production available through Amazon that takes you back a couple generations from Queen Elizabeth to Queen Victoria, and it has been seeing me through. It also is only two seasons with 13 episodes each, so you're going to be able to get through it about as quickly as you did The Crown, but it'll at least, you know, stave off that longing for a little bit longer.
I will have to check that out because British TV series, I think I love because they're often awesome, but also because they are short and manageable, and I can actually like work them into my limited pop culture schedule. So what I have this week, in addition to following my Michigan Wolverines and the March Madness tournament, of course, and by the time this comes out, I dearly hope they have beaten Texas A&M, or I will just go back to being my sad self. But we like to make fun of the fact that as a mother of small children, I don't have time to go to the movies. I never go to movies. I end up like seeing movies on Amazon or Netflix like 5 years after they come out. So I can do reviews for like people who haven't seen anything for years and years. But what I do get to do is I'm kind of obsessed with trailers, because that at least gives me a chance to kind of get a sense of the movies that are out there that I won't have a chance to see. So this week, there were a couple of trailers I was really loving and watching over and over. The first is for the Mr. Rogers documentary. And if you haven't seen this, I love him so much. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Of course. And especially for those of us who have had to watch many, many hours of Daniel Tiger over the last few years of our lives that we can never get back. It is a good reminder of what the original Mr. Rogers was and what his magic was. And I always forget that he was a Methodist minister in addition to everything else. And so this year is the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers first being aired on PBS. And it will just make you feel better about life just watching the few minutes of the trailer. So I can't imagine what watching the actual documentary will do for us when it comes out this summer. And then on a completely frivolous note, there is a movie that is called Tag. And it is apparently based on a true story about some friends who grew up together and have been playing a game of tag for 30 years. And every time they see each other for, I guess, like the month of May, they slap each other and just play this extended game, which frankly, I could never really handle even for half an hour as a child because it just made me anxious to have to worry about whether I was going to be tagged, if I was tagged, if I was going to be able to catch somebody else. Anyway, the cast is amazing in this. We've got John Hamm and Hannibal Buress, Jeremy Renner, Ed Helms, and Isla Fisher, and it's the guy from New Girl, Jake Johnson, maybe? Anyway, please do yourself a favor and watch this trailer. I'm going to make time to see this movie when it comes out, but for now, I'm just going to keep watching the trailer over and over because it is cracking me up. So those are my my pop recommendations for this week. That is all for this week's episode. Thank you, Rachel, for joining us and for filling in Nish. Come back quickly. I hope everything gets to Idaho in one piece, especially Scout's Kylo Ren and Darth Vader costumes, because those are the prized possessions. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, 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 please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations and maybe even bring them to a live show near you. As always, we'll post the show notes on our website. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.